You're listening to Fusion Patrol, a listener-supported podcast. Each week, we take a single episode of a science fiction TV series, movie, or audio and overanalyze it to within an inch of its life. Welcome to the discussion. Hello and welcome to another episode of Fusion Patrol. I'm Eugene.
And I'm Simon.
And tonight we are looking at Bugs, Season 3, Episode 9, Identity Crisis. And from this point forward, I'm going to start these with a disclaimer, because you could be forgiven if you've come to Fusion Patrol new and maybe have an idea of what we're about. So rather than me bring this up every single time during the course of our discussion, I've just had a disclaimer prepared, which I'm going to start off with, and then we'll move into the episode synopsis. Disclaimer. The 1995-1999 BBC series Bugs is mentioned on several lists as being one of the few British science fiction programs to exist in the Doctor Who wilderness years. As such, it is fair game for analysis on Fusion Patrol. However, as our episode-by-episode look at the series has progressed, it has become apparent that by Series 3, Bugs has abandoned any pretense of being science fiction. As compulsive completionists, our reviews will continue until the end. And now episode synopsis. Jan is called before the head of the National Security Executive, and also present is the Director of Communications, Elaine Harmon. They want Jan to take immediate action against the leak in the intelligence organization, identified as David Lance, head of the Central Vetting Office. But Jan pushes back. Lance has a confederate, and Jan is just a few days away from outing them. She's given 24 hours. That night, Jan is kidnapped from her home. Early the next morning, Beckett, Roz, Ed, and Alex are all paged by Jan to report to the office immediately. When they arrive, Jan is someone else. Jan is just a code name, and she's been reassigned. They now work for New Jan, whom we recognize as Elaine Harmon. She informs them that they must move quickly to bring Lance to justice. Old Jan had evidence that needs to be presented to the security executive today, but it is locked up at the Data Storage Agency. Their mission is to break in and steal it because official paperwork is slow and boring. Beckett gets a call from Sir Anthony Fairchild. Jan seems to be missing. He's worried. Beckett and Fairchild go to Jan's flat and find it being ransacked by Lance and his men. They shoot Fairchild and get away. Ed's break-in to the Data Storage Agency doesn't go entirely to plan. He attempts to copy the data, but when his deception is discovered before he finishes copying the data, he escapes with both the incomplete copy and the original disk. Back at HQ, New Jan reveals herself as Lance's accomplice and takes the disk. The real plan is to get Jan's government debit card and passcode, then pop to an ATM and drain the Bureau of Weapons Technology's budget account and skip the country. Oh, and they're apparently called Bureau 2 now. There are just two problems with that plan. The first is that they need two debit cards, and they actually have to present themselves at a bank. The second card rotates amongst high-level government ministers and is currently, conveniently, in the hands of Fairchild. And the pins are on that data disk. They easily secure Fairchild's card and his pin, apparently. Ed calls the bank and tries to explain to the bank manager that two actual government officials will show up with the correct access cards and access codes, and that they shouldn't let them have any money. That conversation goes about as well as you might expect. The team must rush to the bank, where in the nick of time they save the day and the cash. Oh, and there were some subplots about Jan and Beckett having some tender moments while being chased by guys with a bazooka, and Ed and Alex's disastrous date night, but we came for the explosions, not the soap opera. Okay, Identity Crisis. What are your thoughts on Identity Crisis?
Well, I enjoyed the episode itself. I'm a bit surprised by whether, I mean, we've kind of had this thing before of there being someone who is a mole. It's somewhere in the government security apparatus, and we've had this long running thing about Jan trying to identify them. I'm wondering, is this it? I guess that's my first thought. Is this it? Because the people who are the kind of the traitors in this, David Lance and Elaine Harmon, are introduced in this episode, which is not acceptable, sorry.
My first note says, we've been talking about a leak for weeks, and now it's revealed to be two characters that we have never, that have never been in the show before. That's lame.
Yes.
And I feel like these are supposed to be the leak, because Beckett knows about it, and it's Jan's pet project, and she's been mentioning it along. I think this is it, and I think this is a terrible.
It does look like that. It's kind of weird, isn't it? Because, for two reasons. I mean, one is it's episode 9.
Yep.
It's not episode 10. It's not the season finale. And that kind of trailing just yelled, this is a season arc, and you can't end the season arc before you end the season. But also, if they hadn't done that, if we came to this episode without having watched the previous 8, I'd like it. It's really just the fact that I feel like we've been sold something and this episode is delivering something different that is making me feel a little bit shortchanged. I mean, I still like the episode, but what was that? No.
I completely agree. This is terrible. I'm going to come back to something else about our story arc a little bit later. But the other thing that really bugs me about this, and we've seen it before, sort of, there is a big security apparatus going on. The British government obviously has a big security apparatus. And yet, Jan, who is possibly soon to be promoted to the security executive and is obviously highly placed and career-driven, the highlight of her career is a four-man team that's like Bureau 2. They couldn't even get them is this the first time they've called it Bureau 2?
It's not called Bureau 2. They're referring to the fact that it is the second incarnation of the Bureau of Weapons Technology.
She says to the emergency operator, I've got the chief of Bureau 2 here with me. I'm here with the chief of Bureau 2.
All right.
Maybe
this.
I've had people tell me that this is called Bureau 2, but I've seen no evidence of that in the show up till this point. And then today it's like, okay, it's Bureau 2.
All right.
That's also a lame name.
It's why it's Bureau 2, because the Blatty version was Bureau 1 then. Except like World War One, they didn't call it World War One at the time. I mean, Bureau One at the time.
maybe. I mean, it doesn't seem consistent with the way these agencies are named around this place. I mean, they've got such great names as the Data Storage Agency, Central Vetting Office, the Communication Office, and let's not forget the Hive.
Of all of those, I think Bureau 2 is the best name. I like Bureau 2 as a name, actually.
The others sound more like government names, not counting the Hive. Not counting the Hive,
no,
unless that's an acronym.
I think it was an acronym, but MI5, you know.
Ministry of Intelligence, Department 5, right?
Yeah. No, I mean, it is an acronym. No, what's an acronym? Initialism.
Initialism, yes. Sir.
It's military intelligence, not ministry. It's military intelligence.
Right.
But it doesn't actually fit with the way they're organized. Anyway, the point is, names get attached to things and they stick beyond the kind of organizational structure to which they belong. But I don't necessarily have a problem with the name. I do agree with you that it is kind of strange. Not so much that Jan thinks that this is the pinnacle of her career, but that the dialogue suggests that it is just four people, whereas, yeah, never mind the rest of the government security apparatus, because I think they are part of a much broader, you know, National Security Executive or whatever it's called oversees a lot of other stuff, including the Department of Data Storage. But it's one of those kind of slightly strange things about this, the way Bugs is done on a budget, that they manage to give you the impression that our team are part of the Bureau, quite a key part of the Bureau, but there could be entire other offices of people supporting them down the corridor. And because Jan isn't normally as central to the episode as she is in this one, she could be off, you know, managing other teams of people, and all of that's kind of fine until you get that rather strange piece of dialogue saying, no, no, they're the only ones. And it reminds me, I mean, or it's emphasized, I guess, by that very strange scene in this episode where Jan escapes from her kidnappers into a public street that is absolutely full of cars, and the kidnappers follow her firing guns, which is usually the kind of thing that other people take notice of and react to in some way. And there is literally no one else around.
That's on my notes too.
It's like the world of Bugs is they don't even worry about the fact that it's in a vacuum. Yes.
I think it's a holodeck. There are no actual people here. This is just some sort of fantasy illusionary world that they're...
Well, the Bureau of Weapons Technology has no one else in it. The streets have no one else in it. Bugs World is just our protagonists and our antagonists fighting it out in an empty universe.
And you know, there are some circumstances where we have commented on that. I'm thinking of the one where they were running around the light rail, the Docklands light rail, for the dog, I think. I think the episode was with the dog, Newton's Run. And you go, well, you know, that is what it would look like Sunday morning. This is not Sunday morning. We know this is 7:30 on a weekday when they're called in, and they have until about 4 or 5 p.m. that day before the bank closes to accomplish this mission. So they're on, I believe, what you would call a high street. There are businesses along the... and cars everywhere, and not a human being to be found. And not a policeman coming. Oh, what's all this with a bazooka going off in town? It's like, no.
Well, we know there are no police in Bugs. I guess they make that rule from the Avengers, but we're never seeing a policeman as far as I remember.
Maybe that fake guy that came in on the motorcycle, was he a cop?
Oh, yeah, but that wasn't a real cop, was it? But it proves the existence of cops, because you wouldn't dress up as
disguise yourself. Say that to the people who dress up as gray aliens. You wouldn't put on a costume of something that doesn't exist. Maybe.
Well, all right, the concept exists. Maybe cops in the Bugs universe are things that conspiracy theorists tell each other about.
Remember, we had cops back in the
20s? State agency who have the power to arrest you.
Imagine that. Yeah. that was also rather... and, you know, let's face it, the bazooka was there because they were low on their quota of booms. It's not the logical weapon to be chasing somebody who's escaping on the streets on foot. I don't think a bazooka is a particularly mobile... Well, I mean, it is. Obviously, it's a shoulder mounted, but it's not a thing you probably want to run a long distance with.
And there was absolutely no reason for them to have, had the bazooka in the first place. I mean...
Yeah.
What was they were going to use
it for? The bazooka. The guns are no good. It's like, no, I think actually the guns would be more useful. Fire more often. Yeah. Hide them a little better.
Bugs.
Yeah, it's
and
bugs.
We need big explosions. Yeah. We need them to blow up that unidentifiable box of I don't know what. When they're running along the canal side, Jan and Beckett hide behind this, what looks like a huge, big slab of concrete, but actually blows apart like a cardboard box that's been painted green. And there's no even attempt at kind of saying, oh, this is an electricity substation or a telephone cabinet or something like that. It's just, nope. Random prop in the street. Let's blow it up.
Well, at least they got Jan's flat later on, which, you know, I feel sorry for her because she's been living in that flat for over 20 years, presumably.
Oh, yes.
Because Fairchild used to have a key before he got married, before he had a daughter who grew up and got sort of married. And it's like, I mean, yes. She'd been there a very long time. I mean, it looks like a nice place, living in an apartment rented inside of a mansion or a manor house or something.
Well, look at it this way. She's probably overdue a redecoration, so it could have been worse.
Fair enough. And they've got all that cash out at the bank, so probably just pay for it with the bills. You think that would be covered?
What would be covered?
Well, redecorating your house if it's blown up in the line of duty.
On insurance, yeah.
On the expense account.
Oh, yeah, well, I guess she's in charge of it, so probably.
Fair enough.
Speaking of accommodation, suddenly Beckett's living on a boat. I quite like that. We've not seen that before, and then, boom, waking up on a boat.
Yeah.
Right?
And he hates it because it's a little box, and it's like, you know. But it's cheap because he's still so destitute, he can't afford somewhere to live. I did a little check, and the chief of a bureau in the UK government, well, with him being chief of Bureau 2, currently makes about £117,000 a year.
And well, that's not enough to live in London in today's prices, is it?
I don't know. I genuinely don't know. A deputy director makes about £75,000, but which, I don't know, he doesn't feel like the head of an agency, frankly. You know, he definitely has this sort of I'm second dog here the whole time attitude, but yeah.
That's why Roz was the boss. I mean, that made sense. Roz feels like the kind of person who should be in charge. Beckett doesn't. But then I also kind of feel like if Beckett chose to live on a barge because it was, you know, what he wanted to do, that would make him more interesting. There'd be more to his character, but
no. And they didn't blow it up.
Yet.
Maybe next week. Yeah. Maybe that's it. They set this up for next week.
Yeah.
Because we talked about the leak, I'm just going to mention this one now because it's right in front of my notes. I think it's interesting that they keep, you know, they've mentioned that leak throughout the series and, you know, yay, we got it. But there's another thing that they keep mentioning, and they mentioned it again in this episode, and that is CyberX and the previous bureau chief.
Thingy Blatty.
Yeah, they have they're still reminding us of that, and like it does no good no point if it's not coming back.
Yeah, that came up first or second episode of the season, I think. Mm-hmm. And then they're still going on about it now. This is no longer tying into the series prior continuity. This is keeping something in our minds because
so
it has
think
some
planning ahead. Yeah.
Yeah, it has some relevance.
Speaking of how security agencies work, and I, you know, I actually thought about that. I didn't work for a security agency, but I've worked for a government agency and at a sort of section chief head level, and which would be below a department head level, let's say. And, you know, sometimes you do get a new boss, but really? You didn't check with anybody at all to verify that new Jan is actually in charge? And I'm
but
not
new
saying
Jan
she
actually is in charge.
Yeah, no, I'm not saying that she isn't actually in charge, but she walks in and says, I'm new Jan, go break into the data security agency and get some evidence, which we have every right to have, but I just don't want to spend the time on the paperwork, and nobody there questions this.
Well, I would, yes, that'd be my thing. I wouldn't question, or maybe they did even question whether she is the new Jan. I mean, I guess my point is even if you had checked and yes, indeed, she is the new Jan, because she's an unknown quantity, a new boss who you haven't worked with before, who asks you to do something suspect and not necessarily by the book, you might want to go over her head and go, is this okay? Should we be actually committing burglary against another government agency?
Especially when you would think that the security executive could say, oh, we need that stuff. Dear data security agency, get it.
Well, I get why they don't. I mean, I think this is mishandled. I think you can lay the blame for all that kind of stuff at the door of stories like Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, where you have someone high up in the organization who is a traitor, and you can't follow the kind of normal procedures because doing so would alert them to the fact that you know about that.
That's not what's happening here, though.
No, but I think that's what they're aiming for here. The reason it's a setup like that, where they say, yeah, I mean it just doesn't make sense, but it should. They're saying Lance is a known traitor, but there is someone else working with Lance. We don't know who. So, if that person were, for example, in the DSA, you risk alerting them if you go through normal channels. But of course,
but we do know who is in that.
She knows who the other person is,
and she's characterizing that information as the information to tell us who it is. And she doesn't say we need to get it secretly so that they aren't tipped off. She says it'll take too long with the paperwork, and we've got a meeting today at 5. that's the part that's just like, you're right, it's badly handled. There's definitely could have been a way to make our team think there was a good reason for doing this, but she does not. She just, I'm in a hurry.
I will give one of the kind of, I mean, I agree, it's if not well done. One of the things that I will give credit to this episode is that it moves fast enough that it can get away with quite a straightforward plot. Like, Nujan is just very obviously the bad person who, the other mole within the department. It's almost so obvious to the point you think this has to be a kind of distraction, but it's not. And, you know, it quickly becomes apparent. But in a way, that's because this episode isn't really bothering with any of that stuff. You've got a cast of characters who basically are what they appear to be. So Lance
WYSIWYG
is just a thoroughly no good. Yeah, they're WYSIWYG. And Nujan is obviously a traitor. And Fairchild, by using a character who has previously appeared and has been established as sympathetic, you know is not going to be a traitor. And so you don't have any kind of really irritating surprise twists that aren't earned, because you don't have twists. I mean,
no.
That's okay with me. I don't need twists in every episode. The point about this story is it's fast-paced and action-packed, and it's a really kind of, because it's a character-centered story, I guess, focused on Jan, who has up to now been a minor character. And Jan Harvey is great in this. I mean, I think she really sells the episode.
Yeah. You know, there was almost a twist. There was that moment when Beckett tries the whole, so that whatever her name was from 2 episodes ago, that's your daughter?
Yeah.
And then we thought, ooh, nope. Actually, no.
It's kind of weird, though. Why? I mean, I guess I did think, is that her daughter? But then I also thought, why would she not say it's her daughter? I mean, it's an odd assumption, I think.
It's only an assumption you would make in television land.
Yeah. Well, it's an assumption that we'd make as viewers, because we're expecting that kind of twist. But
yeah,
for Beckett in story, it's quite a leap, I think. Especially since it seems to be wrong.
Yes. Yeah. I think it is. I think it probably is wrong. Yeah. And not Jan. Just that she seemed to be, I mean, maybe she is much more duplicitous, but in that moment, she seemed to be like, no, you know, it seemed genuinely plausible, sort of. sort of genuinely plausible, but yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I'd be surprised if we see Julia back. I don't know, but
I would be too. I would be too. She should be crushed. She should still be crushed somewhere. Tough as old boots or not, you don't get married to a guy that planned the whole thing as a way to get you killed and steal from your father.
Hello, Donna Noble. Well, it wasn't quite the same reason, but still a similar plot line.
Yeah, but I don't think afterwards. Yeah, sort of. That's why Donna's not a very believable character.
You can't criticize Donna.
She could be a likable character. She does not have to be necessarily believable, but she's a bit of a stereotype. But yeah. Let's see. What else have we got?
Well, if you want to claim this isn't science fiction in your disclaimer, you're going to have to overlook the extremely nifty little electronic pick lock. And actually, you know, the CCTV jammer, that, you know, that had some little flashing lights that would go round and round inside the envelope. That was good.
But I don't think it's
not high concept sci-fi like we had early on.
No, it's not integral to the plot either. It's like the doctor needs a sonic screwdriver to get through a door kind of thing.
The kind of bugs thing is always that their USP is they're kind of using tech to thwart naughty people.
What was previously tech crimes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Crimes involving tech.
It was somewhat to my surprise, you know, because it didn't quite... That was how I remembered this show. It was that the kind of sci-fi element was the kind of actually engineering fi, that they were using whizzy kind of technology that was, you know, 5 seconds into the future. And some of those early episodes were actually much more interesting than that because they were exploring sci-fi concepts.
Yeah.
So I kind of agree with you, I think. The pick lock and the jammer were only marginally more advanced than the zip drive that we saw used in this. The zip drive.
The jazz, wasn't it?
What did I make of zip drive?
Yeah, I think it was. Yeah, it was definitely labeled jazz drive on the on the disc. Yeah, I remember those. They were the coolest thing ever. I probably still have some floating around here.
I've still got mini discs.
I wish I still had a Bernoulli disc. Remember the bigger ones? They were like the zip drives, except that they were probably close to 8 inches square. And they went in and they relied on the fact they spun a lot faster than a floppy disk. They were soft, but as they reached speed, they became rigid. And then that's how they were able to act. Oh, yeah, they were cool. And then they made zip drives, which I think were the exact same technology, just writ small. But we used to have some of those at a place I used to work where we did construction software. They would use them for backups and stuff. It's kind of cool. I miss old useless technology. I thought the lockpit was just a knife, to be quite honest.
Oh, it was a knife with a little flashing light on it and batteries.
Ah, I did not see the flashing light when he zapped it. So maybe that's what Ed used the other day. Because remember, Ed used a knife the other day to get into a door, and I thought we mentioned it was like a knife. But maybe it was a flashy pick lock, and they just didn't shoot it right to see the flash. Yeah. Let's see. The other thing I did think was, if you want advancing technology to the future, how about a debit card with two chips on it?
Yeah, what could be more advanced than a debit card with a chip on it?
A debit card two with chips.
Two chips, yes.
that whole... Okay, so you've got the alpha card, you've got the beta card. Okay. I'm not convinced this is the right way to handle government funds. To be fair, I'm thinking there should, in fact, I don't know, be some sort of accounting for this, but it is an intelligence agency. And then, so Jan's got the card, but the access code is on the storage file? It's like, so Jan can't use the card without going down to the data storage agency and getting the code, or just she got it memorized and that's just a backup? Wasn't quite sure. And then did they also get...
All of the codes were on there, but yeah, how you would normally access it is not clear. But none of that bothered me anything like as much as a rota of cabinet ministers holding a bank card.
What?
Yeah. What? Absolutely insane.
It's security. And then does he know his PIN? do they have to change the PIN every 3 weeks when they rotate?
I have no idea. And the only reason they've done it is because they brought Fairchild back. They established that he was a cabinet minister a couple of episodes ago, so they've got to have some pretext for why he's the one with the card. But it is.
It's cheap.
Utterly ludicrous.
It's cheaper that way. We've already got the guy in, so we'll just make him the minister that has it this week.
Yeah. Well, I understand why they brought the character back, but
coincidence of him also being
strange.
Yeah. This week's card holder, was a little bit weird. But I can't help feeling that there should be a better system for dealing with your money. But, you know, it's your tax money, so you guys deal with it however you think is the right way. I'm just going to point out that at one point Jan conks a man on the head with a honking great metal fire extinguisher, and he's not dead.
Well, she does kind of hit him on the skull with it. She's not, like, caving in his temple or anything.
I just feel like that would probably cause a lot more trauma than what he exhibited.
Well, he certainly looks a bit dazed by it. I mean, I have to say that we've criticized people doing stupid things in order to create dramatic jeopardy in Bugs before. Jan, both when the kidnappers find her in her, when she spots the kidnappers in her flat and does that escape, and then in her various escape attempts from the kidnappers, Jan does pretty well, I think. She's pretty handy. And yeah, a couple of times she does get caught, but it's not because she's not doing the smart thing each time. And in particular, the way in which she kind of absolutely picks her moment and doesn't act until there's a, you know, significant chance of success is impressive.
Yeah, I'll agree with that. She was not stupid. I did question at one moment when she jumped outside in the planter if maybe she should have just sat there in the planter for a while they, you know, went elsewhere in the building, because it was pretty clear they weren't going to look there until they had seen the rope twitching outside. But,
oh, I see.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, maybe. But on the other hand, my interpretation was that as soon as the guy got back and found the one that she'd beamed with the fire extinguisher, they were going to start pretty much combing every part of the building, starting from the room she'd been kept in, which was close by, so...
Yeah, maybe. Those two maybe felt like a, quick, get to the front door before she gets out, kind of henchman, but...
Yeah, I mean, I think we've been conditioned by what we expect Bugs characters to do, so yeah, kind of.
Yeah. Now, before we get on to the last thing I have on my notes, I just want to ask, because I'm pretty sure it's not like that here, but I live in the desert in Arizona, and are there enough operas to go to one every Thursday night in London?
Every Thursday night?
Isn't that what they said?
I mean, good Lord, yes, of course there are. There are opera houses, you know. There will be venues that just show operas.
Sure, but do they not have, like...
Is there a different one, you mean?
I'm sure I could go to the same... Sure, I could go to the same play every night, too, but eventually, you kind of...
No, you would go to different venues. Well, if you wanted to go every single night, you'd go to different venues. But by a week later, yes, I think you might well have a different opera. I mean, it depends. It entirely depends, but you will have productions that tour. Actually, I don't know about this in London. This is London, isn't it? But yeah, you'll have productions that tour around. So, I definitely don't think you'd have a problem in London if you only wanted to go to a different opera once a week. I'm sure you could go to a different opera every night. I've never tried it, but it wouldn't surprise me. I don't think I'd be able to go to a different opera every night in rural Wales. But, probably the
Fair
same
enough.
Problem as Arizona.
I think we're a little less rural, but yeah, I think we're a little less rural, 2 million people or something like that. But none of them go to the opera, or very few. That's not fair. There is a Phoenix Opera Company, and there are places, but I just was like, wow, once a week for it. Presumably a different opera. That's a whole lot of old stuff.
Man.
So the only other thing I've got, I think, listed on my is to talk about the soap opera time. Let's start with Ed and Alex. I just want to say, this is why you don't fish off the company pier. Alex is going to get Ed killed with her salty behavior. I mean, she came through, but I there were times there where I felt like this could jeopardize Ed's life.
It's not long since we had that episode where there was a couple getting married, though. What?
Yeah. Yeah, and see how that's messed with them.
Yeah, that proves your point, but it's all, obviously also a thing in Bugs.
Well, it would have to be, because there are absolutely no other people in this world.
Well, yeah.
The streets are empty. There's just the people we know in the services, and the people who obviously perform the operas, and then the baddies occasionally. Yeah.
I'm not keen on the kind of Alex and Ed dynamic in this episode, partly because Alex has kind of gradually diminished, certainly in my opinion, over the season, from being this kind of badass filing clerk at the start to being a bit, I still like the performance. I still enjoy the kind of, she seems like a kind of, I guess, a relatively fun character, but just the way that she is with Ed is just kind of quite random, awful, irrational, annoying. And Ed isn't that much better. So I thought that was the weak point of what you're going to call the kind of soap opera dimension. I thought that the Beckett, Jan, Fairchild stuff was extremely well done. I enjoyed all of that. Possibly not Beckett kissing Jan on the head in the warehouse, but apart from that.
Yeah, I mean, that did seem like a decent humanization of Jan. And, you know, she's in a vulnerable moment the whole time. I mean, no matter how tough she is, you don't get kidnapped and run around the city in your nightwear and not be somewhat with your guard off. And that is a good opportunity for Beckett to get in there, plus having Fairchild there, to get in there and understand that person better. And understanding helps.
Yeah, but also the way they do it plays up the strength of her character, in my opinion. She's not brittle. And what we have seen is someone who is quite reserved and quite closed with the team under normal circumstances. But she's reacting to the situation that she's in. And it makes sense that she should be more open. And so when they are kind of in that situation of running, you know, of being threatened together and that kind of sense of mutual dependency, I like the fact that she doesn't get all defensive about Beckett's questioning or whatever. She doesn't say, how dare you ask me that, or behave as if it's unreasonable.
Don't call me Barbara ever again.
Yeah, she behaves in a way that just emphasizes her resilience in a pressurized situation, I think, her adaptability. So I did that whole aspect of this episode, I did really appreciate.
I would say that, yeah, as relationship, if we want to call it that, melodrama, whatever, goes in this season of Bugs, it's the highlight, because the rest of it's been pretty, I mean, for all characters, Roz, Channing, Beckett, Ed, Alex, all of it has been really bad soap opera stuff, and this was at least well done. So yeah, all right. And so the coda there at the end where Roz is talking with Beckett and he's apparently spilling all confidential information that he's received about Jan to Roz, about her and Fairchild.
It's not confidential.
Well, it's personal.
It's personal, but Jan isn't kind of saying, I'm swearing you to secrecy. She's just being a bit more open. Yeah.
Have some discretion, Beckett. Look, put around and go, well, did you hear Fairchild in line? Come on. Like, that's...
I don't know.
For me.
I'm not one to defend Beckett, but I think I can imagine in a situation like that where I'd been told stuff and it was not stuff that I had been asked to keep secret, and I was working closely with a kind of someone else who knew the other party, and, you know, I felt close to someone, and it's trust, whatever's going on between Roz and Beckett, that is a kind of established trusting relationship they've got there. So,
but
I get it.
I'm going to come back and say that sure, in the moment, Jan volunteered information. She did not say, Beckett, I'll break your nose if you tell anybody any of this. She didn't do any of that. But he's got good reason to believe that that's generally not widely disseminated information. Like, starting with when he went to Fairchild.
But he's not widely disseminating it.
I didn't even know her last name. And Fairchild's like, and I didn't say I was going to tell you it either. And right, there is a certain amount of secrecy around Jan where she wouldn't have a code name. She wouldn't have bit at them when they called her Barbara. So I, you know, it's like, yeah, you found this out in the line of your work. And I don't know. No.
It was never work. He was just being nosy. He didn't need to ask any of those questions.
He only got that. He didn't need to answer any of those questions, but he did it in the circumstances where they are on the job. He's rescuing her.
Yeah.
That is a let's go with privileged position there. I don't know. And you know darn good and well, if he told that to Ed, it would be all over the rest of the staff. Oh, wait, that would just be Alex. Yep. But still...
Because
it is all over the rest of the staff. Now,
Yeah.
But when we get to that scene, and Roz is kind of like, yeah, you know, that's a long time to live with regrets about not doing the thing. Isn't that right, Beckett? Eh. And, yeah. And he gets up and walks away. Like, that was just a painful scene.
I liked that as well. No, I liked it.
Get on with it, Beckett. You were willing to do it last week. You even did do last week.
Yeah, but we're not expecting him to do it. Well, I mean, I guess I wasn't expecting to have the mole revealed in episode 9, but we're not expecting him to do it in episode 9. That's episode 10.
No, because the mole has to be Alex, because she's the only character that we could be like, oh my gosh, it's Alex? Because we know it can't possibly be Ed Roth. I don't think it is.
My question is, are we going to get Channing back? Are we going to see Channing again, or is Channing out of it for now? Because I still feel suspicious of Channing.
I agree. Channing seemed like, you know, he was the only other person along the lines, and he's not really in the agency, so...
No, he's not, but he's up to no good.
I'm assuming Channing's business has revived CyberAct somehow. That's probably what they're doing there in California at that plant. But he's... that he's setting up. I don't know. I really don't know. The structure of this show has been so haphazard, like revealing the mole and like having the whole Channing setting him up like he's a baddie and then he's gone. I don't know. I am eagerly anticipating the next episode because I feel like they've got a lot of work to do. They got a lot of work to do in the next episode. To tie this up in a satisfying way. Yeah, I don't know. Let me ask this question. Did Alex... We only got a little bit of information about what Alex was upset about with Ed on their date.
Well, basically she was upset because he was charming and funny. That's
what it sounded like, yes. It embarrassed her that he was charming and funny. Now, okay, he flirted with a waitress. That's through her perspective, you know. Was he flirting with the waitress? I don't know. Or was he just, you know, being an Australian? And that's...
yeah, you know, I get complaints at all. So, like, I mean, he talked to the waitress, and it wasn't about the weather.
So, I mean, yeah.
Jammed with the band. It's like, you know, some people like that stuff. And we mentioned it, but I'll just mention WYSIWYG, really? They had to spell out WYSIWYG for us?
It's 1997.
That was your computer science lesson for the day. WYSIWYG.
It's in character that Ed wouldn't know what it stands for.
Sure, Ed can't use a mouse.
Yeah, you remembered.
So, yeah, I fly a helicopter, but cannot pilot a mouse.
Yeah.
Do you have anything else on this one?
No, I think I'm done with it. It's not that I didn't like the episode. It's just that, as I say, it was sort of quite straightforward.
Yeah. Next time, then, is the season finale entitled Renegades, which honestly, just like I know nothing about it. I genuinely know nothing about any of the future episodes of. I have scrupulously avoided that sort of thing. But Renegades sounds to me once again like the episode where Roz was on the run.
I was going to say, I thought we'd already had an episode called Renegade, but actually it was called Fugitive. So,
yes. Renegade sounds like the whole group goes rogue for some reason. So maybe that's what happened. Jan gets promoted to the national security executive and they're all put on the most wanted list or something. I don't know. But
well, who knows? I didn't think we felt that Fugitive was a very accurate description of the episode. So
yeah,
this may also fall short of the Trades Descriptions Act.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. Maybe it's Diet Renegades. If they called it Diet Renegades, it would be okay. Simon, thank you for joining me.
It's a pleasure, as always.
And listeners, I do hope you'll join us all again next time on Fusion Patrol. You've been listening to Fusion Patrol. Thanks for listening. If you've enjoyed this episode, we hope you'll consider supporting us at buymeacoffee.com/fusionpatrol or patreon.com/fusionpatrol. For our monthly Patreon subscribers, we're currently running a special series on Babylon 5. Come join the conversation and find other content at fusionpatrol.com. And we're back on social media, where you can also follow us on Mastodon and the Fediverse. Our address is podcast@fusionpatrol.com. Our music is Fight the Future by Amber Wolf. This has been a Lone Locust production. On the next episode of Fusion Patrol, we'll be looking at two more episodes of Neo Ultra Q, episodes 11 and 12. In the Argos Democracy, we discuss the sad third wheel that is Sohei, ponder pro-kaiju terrorists, and ask, is democracy a trolley problem? And in Hominis Dignitati, the final episode of Neo Ultra Q, we discuss what we've learned so far about Jin. Come join the conversation on Fusion Patrol.